So today is the 12th of January, 2017. We're at the home of Jim and Jody Wergler. This is part 7 of an oral interview at the Grand Canyon Historical Society Oral History Program. And my name is Tom Martin. So I'm at the table here with Jim and Jody. And Jim, the last interview, we were talking about some of the operations of the Grand Canyon Clinic, and I wondered if you could cover some of the types of medicine that you saw at the Grand Canyon as it would have compared to Yosemite.
Okay. Well, I have to kind of gather my thoughts a little bit since it's been a while since we talked. But my recollection is that we had pretty much just gotten to Grand Canyon, and we're getting things doing the things that they had been doing, but adding to it in many regards. The nurse who had been here for many years was Lucy Egan, and she was just highly regarded in the community and in the medical community, as well as the Grand Canyon community, as being kind of the glue that had held the clinic together for years and years. And I would have to agree that that she was a critical part of making it work. She always seemed to be around at the right time. She was when we asked her to do something, she would jump to it and figure out a way to make it happen. So then, of course, we've already mentioned the role that Chris Becker played. I believe we've covered that pretty well. And one of the reasons that he left Yosemite and came to Grand Canyon was because, first, he basically grew up in Nevada. So he was sort of a desert rat, self-described. And he was looking for a change of scenery. He came to, as mentioned before, came to Grand Canyon, to Yosemite in 1978. And then he came over here just before I did in 89. So he came to work both in the lab and X-ray, because he had those skills and certifications. And then we had the regular full-time lab and X-ray person, who was Robert Schneider. And he had been here for a number of years, and he stayed for several years after we left Grand Canyon. And one of the reasons this is really has some significance is that the ability to perform lab chemistries in a rural environment. At the time, it required a major piece of machinery that did a lot of these things automatically, but cost tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, new. And of course, that kind of stuff shows up frequently on the used equipment market, and particularly since our parent corporation was Samaritan Health System, which is now the Banner Health, and so we had access to one of these machines that would do 12 or 15 or 20 chemistries with one run, you know. Draw blood, put it in the right slots, and when it's done, you've got 15, for anywhere from 10 to 20 answers. And in the world of medicine in general, if you're not just completely flying by the seat of your pants, you need to have some numbers that you could count on to give you some notion of what you need to do to treat a person's particular illness. And this leads me to a totally different aspect of practicing medicine at Grand Canyon compared to Yosemite, which is that we've talked about this before, because Yosemite is very highly developed in terms of people participating in all kinds of physical activities, climbing rocks and climbing mountains and skiing and rafting and particularly hiking. They had what are called the High Sierra camps in Yosemite, where people all have to do is carry a day pack and be able to hike in the neighborhood of 7 or 8 miles a day to get from one camp to the next, where there would be a meal prepared by a staff and a person and sleep on cots with a mattress and with blankets. And like I say, it was a substantial step up from just putting everything on your back and, you know, trotting through the wilderness. And it was, if a person could afford it or had friends in high places, this was the way to go. And I got to go on some of those, and that's part of a big part of my memories from Yosemite, of the good times. But anyway, in Grand Canyon, everything is upside down. In Yosemite, you start at 4,000 feet, and then you climb up to 10,000 feet, and then back down again. And it's basically hard going up, and it's easier coming down. In Grand Canyon, the mountain is pretty much upside down. This is how rangers and others tend to think of it, because you start at South Rim, which is right at 7,000 feet, if I remember correctly, because Williams is 6,700, and we are virtually the same elevation that the South Rim is. And then the North Rim is another 1,000 feet higher than that. But to get anywhere in Grand Canyon, basically you go down first. And you start in shoulder seasons. You may start in ice and snow at the South Rim. And you may then get down to the bottom of the canyon, which is a full mile in elevation difference, 5,000 feet. And then in the summertime, then you have to climb out. Then you have to walk out carrying whatever it is that you are carried down in there with you. So it makes people behave differently in terms of how they pack, how they plan their hiking trips, how they look at their physical preparation to be able to climb out. And this is particularly important in the summertime then, because the temperatures at the bottom of the canyon at Phantom Ranch were routinely within a degree or two of what the temperatures are in Phoenix on a hot summer day. So as anybody who has lived in Arizona and done outdoors kind of things and follows the weather in Arizona, Phoenix routinely, I mean, they'll have a whole month where the temperature every day is over 100. The temperature will be 110 or over for at least 10 days in a row. And it just keeps getting worse as time goes by. But this then generated a little bit of things that we've talked about of how to anticipate what kind of medical problems were going to be encountered and how they were going to be dealt with. And in the early 90s, the helicopters were available. There was a ship that was, what's the term, basically a leased ship was that was available to Park Service and Rangers. Part of the problem was just finding a place where a helicopter can land or getting a person to those points. The Park Service had rangers posted at Indian Gardens, which is roughly halfway between here and the river, if I remember correctly. But the kind of areas where people would have difficulty is that initially, when I first got here, the bugaboo for people hiking into the canyon would be dehydration. And very early in the years that we were engaged with the Park Service, not only at Yosemite, but also here, in the whole issue of training and certifying rangers to be able to provide health care in the field and be in compliance with the certifying agencies, such as the state health boards and that sort of thing. All these sort of the regulatory minutiae meant that there was just a lot of negotiating, not really so much on my part as it would be on the part of the EMS coordinator for the Park Service. They had their own organization park-wide, Park Service-wide, not just Grand Canyon-wide. So there was always this ongoing discovery, learning about people, what kind of problems they would have in the Tetons and Yellowstone and the East Coast parks, Smoky Mountains, etc., on and on. But our particular problem at Grand Canyon was relatively unique because people wouldn't really get into trouble until they started coming out. They would hike into the canyon. They would start in the morning. Weather wasn't too bad. It wasn't too hot. By the time that they got down to the river, if they hadn't been replacing the fluids that they lost through sweating and evaporation, they then would turn around and start coming back up the trail, and somewhere after hiking maybe an hour or two uphill, people would start getting nauseated. They would start demonstrating the symptoms of heat illness, and eventually, if that wasn't attended to in a timely way, would eventually lead potentially to heat stroke, which is of the three heat disorders, the heat stroke is the one that really needs to be treated as a bona fide emergency because people die of it. So there was a ranger on the force when we first got here by the name of Nancy Beacom, and she was an RN, and she had particular interest in doing research and learning.
So I'm just going to jump in for a second. That's M-E-C-H-A-M.
Is that
Nancy Meekum?
Okay. Yeah. All right. Just so we know.
Thank you.
I think it is because I always get confused about that. Yeah. Is it the usual Meekum, M-E-A-C-H-E-M, or is it, but I think you're right. It is M-E. I guess we can check. You can Google that. Yeah. Okay. All right. So anyway, she would be posted for like a week at a time, and some maybe more, down at Indian Gardens. And the folks who were the ranger force down there, they'd be up at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning to start their what do you call it, where they would just get out on the trail to see who was in trouble. At that time, this seems so impossible to talk about now, the cell phones that were really truly portable, I was just reading yesterday, the smartphone was introduced to the world 10 years ago. Did you know that? Smartphone was introduced to the world 10 years ago.
In 2007.
So here we are talking about the 90s, the 1990s. So primitive. big boxes, And the amount of the amount of battery capacity was based on how long a person could hold a 1 to 2 pound object to their ear, and not have to stop and sort of recharge because it was so they were so heavy. You didn't hike with them. People did not hike with cell phones really in those days. Plus, once the rangers found somebody who was medically incapacitated for whatever it looked like, it was a guessing game as to whether or not they were dehydrated or overhydrated. And that wasn't even really appreciated at that time. It was the whole issue of fluid management was a big deal for athletes. The colleges and universities and high schools in the South, you know, there was a fairly high mortality rate back in the 70s, 80s, 90s of high school kids who the conventional wisdom at that time for coaches who coached that age group was that you developed your toughness by not taking fluids, by not drinking water. It was a test of your resolve, and whether or not you were tough enough to be in this football game on this team was that you actually would not. Now the Army knew better than this for decades, because the Army people would be issued salt tablets, right? So along with their canteen of water, they had salt tablets. And the issue of whether or not a soldier under a commanding officer of some kind, next level up, sergeant, lieutenant, captain, whatever, if a soldier, I was told this over the years, and I was once a soldier myself, if a soldier was rendered incapacitated, could not serve his duties as a quote fighting man, as a result of either sunburn or water salt related incapacity, the higher level person was the one who might get court-martialed because he was not taking proper care of his men. If a private recruit stripped down to his shorts and decided to get, you know, a lot of sun, get the old sun bath business going and all the rest of it, if he got so badly burned that he couldn't function and perform his duties, that was considered to be a lapse in the leadership of the next higher person, and it would wind up as high as the company commander.
Wow.
So the Army was probably pretty had a reasonable handle on this, but the sophistication that they had was you drink lots of water and you eat lots of salt. and that sufficed pretty much for the time, partly because of the deficiency in the ability to actually study what's going on. You know, when you have a company of recruits who are 18 years old, and one or two or three of them collapse on a 20-mile hike. So, what caused them to collapse? Well, you don't have your $200,000 chemistry machine at your side to draw blood and all the rest of it. During our time at Grand Canyon, and not because of anything we did, but the sophistication of the ability to do miniaturize the capability of all kinds of stuff. This is going to be a sidebar. You can do with this what you want to. I was watching TV last week, and they were talking about the Affordable Care and the whole issue of how of they were particularly talking about the whether or not the NASA was going to try and send a person to Mars. And what's our friend, the guy with the mustache? The astrophysicist?
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
DeGrasse Tyson.
Yes.
He's the head of the Hayden Planetarium in New York. And is a really popular, he's popularized a lot of the stargazing kind of stuff. He made this following point. If you walk into a hospital intensive care unit, probably a little bit exaggerated, but not much. You walk into a facility where there are people hooked up to machines and there's all kinds of stuff going on. Anything that has an on-off switch on it, you got to turn it on, you got to turn it off. Any device that has to have a switch on it to work was developed during the time of NASA's sending men to the moon. And they were developed by physicists who had no interest in medicine. I thought that was so cool. That just sort of, I just love hearing that kind of stuff. And I'll do another sidebar here. Just after we got here, I was invited to go to Houston as a member of a group of doctors and other people who were engaged, who were NASA. It was an invitation to come be a consultant for NASA. And the reason that I got into that was because the guy who preceded me at Grand Canyon was Bill...
Roger Bilica.
And, of course, Roger kind of was aware of the fact that there was this ongoing work on trying to figure out how to take care of people in the field. And this whole business of wilderness medicine was just starting to get really going, and that they had established a curriculum for wilderness medicine. And Roger, of course, knew of what his own experiences were, and he knew that I had come from Yosemite with 20 years of experience there. So he was kind enough to invite me to come down and serve as a quote, consultant. And one of the ways that NASA was working to try and figure out how do you take care of a person in a spaceship 250,000 miles from Earth, where there's only about two other people. How do you figure out? Well, okay, do they have they gone into some kind of a diabetic crisis? Have they developed some acute illness? You know, what is it? Well, the Kodak company was one of the leaders in trying to develop systems that would use a dry process rather than a bunch of chemicals that you pour into test tubes and stuff. It was based on, I believe, the ektachrome capacity. Somebody who's going to check this years from now, they'll have to look it up and see what the deal is. But Robert Schneider, the lab tech, he had looked at whether or not the ability of these dry process chemistries was, because technically speaking, it would be cheaper. And you don't have to store stuff in refrigerated areas, you know. A dry process, by definition, would be something, it was lightweight. Every ounce that you ship to outer space requires X number of gallons of fuel to do it. And so they are very, very cautious about all this. And this was during the Apollo time, where they had these monster big, you know, rockets to fire off into space. The people at NASA had really kind of gotten into the notion that the ektachrome dry process was going to be their go-to. That was they're going to be their go-to system of how to establish the ability for people in space with a minimum of training to be able to do chemistries and help them. Then they would talk by radio to, you know, to Houston Central, whatever. Well, Robert convinced me that this was not a very accurate system. That they were, you know, you could not really count on the results to be accurate enough. And I'm a true believer, and I've preached this my entire medical career. No number is not as bad as a bad number, or turn it around. A bad number is worse than no number, because you still got your eyes and your ears and your nose and your hands and so forth. But once you plug blood or anything else into a machine, it's kind of like what we have with computers these days. If the computer says that something, you know, is... people will believe the computers instead of their lying eyes. What are you going to believe, you know, the computer or your lying eyes? So it's so I brought this up, and it threw the people at NASA into a tailspin.
Okay, so there was a dry chemical analysis of blood, and there was a more wet, chemically oriented analysis of blood. And what you had found was that the dry analysis results weren't as good as the wet analysis. Is that right, if I understand this as a non-medical technical?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Thank you.
And so, like I say, they had all their eggs in this one basket as to how they were going to provide a lightweight, accurate system to be able to... this whole notion of trying to have a relatively untrained human being on a team of maybe three people in a capsule or space station. Because this was when they were just really... I was a consultant, basically, as part of the development of the space station. And so they were, you know, they were having to look at all these different systems, how you do this, do that, spacesuits, you know, I don't know. They had put all their eggs into the Kodak basket for being able to have a system, but trying to teach a totally untrained lay person, not a medical person, how do you put in a central line? Well, you know, the astronauts are really sharp people, but there's a limit. So who's going to watch the line? So they teach them to put a line in, maybe through the infra, whatever it is up here, the whatever this bone is,
clavicle.
The clavicle, yeah, infraclavicle. You know, there's a big blood vessel in there, or into the jugular. So fine, you get the tube in there and hook it up to your machine, and then what? Who's in an ICU? You've got 24-hour nursing staff. They're the ones who are taking care of all these people once the folks have come in and put in their tubes here and there and all the rest of it. So it was, they've, the submarine service, as a matter of fact, are the people who have this figured out, because they would come up with the number. So you had a medical emergency in space. How long would it take to rig up an ambulance system on a rocket? You know, even if you were prepared to do it, they talked about, okay, fine. Well, when we develop the space station, we'll include an escape module. Okay, yeah, right. But you got to get it up there in the first place. But they're prepared to go through those things. The people who are down in a submarine under the kind of pressures that they have down there, they are stuck. They cannot leave down there. It takes 2 weeks for the pressure, to get the pressure down to the point where they can bring a person. Because, you know, in the submarine service, they have capsules on the ocean floor, that once they get the water knots, the equinots, get their physiology to the point where they can actually just swim in and out of these capsules. I mean, you know, at to a certain depth.
Right.
I mean, we're not talking about the
Mariana 13, Trench or something.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. But when they've got people working, if you try and put the equivalent of a space station into a certain depth of water, they can't get to the surface any sooner than you can get from space to the surface.
Wow.
And the submarine forces, or the Navy people, had put together this system where they had virtually everything on what amounted to discs that could be played, not really on a phonograph, but the equivalent of a digital disc that was the same size, like a 12-inch digital disc that the person who was the designated corpsman, they don't send doctors down on these things, but the aquanauts, or would be the half of the designated guy who's in charge of the healthcare, would be able to deal with the emergency that they were presented with. And they had pretty well covered the waterfront. There's someplace in NASA, there's even a quote from me on one of the things when we gave our presentation, saying, well, if you really want to know how to deal with the situation in space, talk to the submarine service. Talk to the Navy. Thrilled the Navy guy. He was just beside himself, you know, giving him the props. So that was a digression that I did not intend to get into. But
no, this is very good, because okay. It was a question I had. You started off this history today. We were talking about blood chemistry, and the machine to do that at the South Rim when you showed up. Was Robert there? And that was or had he not come in yet? I mean, that machine, when I showed up, I don't know, in the mid-90s, it was a machine bigger than this dining table. It was a big machine, and every day he would have to run through a series of tests to test the numbers and make sure it was calibrated.
Mm-hmm.
That, probably $250,000 machine, I'm assuming.
Yeah, if new.
When did it show up?
Maybe more.
Was it there when you showed up?
Within a year or two of us getting there. So we had a pretty good capability. Once we got the body of the person who was sick into the clinic,
got it.
We had pretty good capability of doing the kind of stuff that would be done in a hospital with full lab capacity. But focused on the kind of things that we needed to know. I mean, none of the esoteric stuff, you know, like, okay, what's your testosterone level, and what's your any kind of hormone levels, any of that kind of stuff. This is strictly the chemicals that are in the human body that are essential for life. Water, sodium, chloride, phosphates, you know, a variety of other things. Those were the kind of things that would get really out of balance if a person was, first off, not drinking enough fluid or drinking too much fluid. So every day we used to have these sort of discussions about, okay, what's the best chemical replacement for a hiker just in general. I mean, because the Rangers were talking about this. It was, you know, people would ask, you know, what should I take? Well, Gatorade was at the top of the list. Gatorade was the first of the replacement fluids that you could take orally and not through an IV. And this was developed in Florida. At whatever the people, who are the Gators in Florida? University of Florida? Well, you're young and keep track of this stuff. Whoever it was, that it was the people there who got the credit for developing the fluid, and also then got the rewards because then they patented it And so somebody, you know, but as you well know, I mean, you're a hiker, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, there's, even then, even in 1990, there were these competing companies putting together replacement fluid substances, and particularly in powder form. This was the really big breakthrough, was having a powder form. Mm-hmm. And you go to foreign countries where they have cholera, and deaths from cholera are caused by loss of fluid and electrolytes from constant, unremitting diarrhea, mostly. So UNICEF or whoever, the UN segment that does healthcare, came up, and you can Google this. You can say what is the formula for fluid replacement, and it's a sort of stuff that every country has in relative abundance. All I got to do is know how much sodium bicarbonate and how much salt to put into a given amount of water. And that is a life-saving substance. I mean, crazy stuff. So anyway, the people who were in the United States who were in essence copying Gatorade but coming up with their own formula, well, is it better to use dextrose or sucrose? You know, these arguments would occupy people around a campfire, you know, all evening. The fact is that there were several that were probably of equal capability. Some of them tasted better than others. But anyway, this became then, as particularly Nancy was down there at Indian Springs, seeing a lot of people with heat and fluid problems. And so she, you know, would take notes and put together the information that she had. And so initially, as you've already kind of pointed out in our conversation, the answer to getting dehydrated was to drink fluids. So we would have people then go overboard. They would take gallons of water, literally, you know this, they would haul gallons of water so that they would drink, half a pint every 15 minutes or 10 or 5, whatever goal they'd set for themselves. And by the time they got down to the bottom, they would kind of tend to get bloated. The people who were hyponatremic, fluid would leave the third space the blood vessels and go into the third space. I've forgotten all that stuff. The fact is that they would be in trouble, and it would also wind up causing brain swelling. So the people who were drinking too much fluids, they were getting into kidney troubles, they were having seizures on the trail. They were going, have neurological deficit would develop on the trail. So what did a ranger do who was carrying in his pack Band-Aids and ACE wraps, maybe a blow-up kind of a splint, possibly? They did not have the information or the ability to do anything more than package them up and get them out of there as quickly as possible and basically get them to the clinic, unless they were on actually death's door, in which case they would fly them on down to Flagstaff. But for the most part, they brought them to the clinic. So we were seeing almost every day multiple people with some form of a heat and fluid disorder. We had the machine that we were able to say, oh, okay, well, this person needs sodium or this person needs water. You know, so, but where it finally reached, and to the best of my knowledge, they're even more sophisticated about it now, than when I left there in 99. But my understanding is the Rangers now carry in their backpack a small device, somewhat bigger than a smartphone. It's substantially bigger, unless they've miniaturized it further. But they can do a finger stick and get within a couple of minutes of time the answer to what's going on with their electrolytes. And they also then, of course, as part of that whole picture, we receive training. The other thing they would carry in their backpack is fluids, IV fluids. They could start an IV, and they could start actually the process of replacing whatever needed to be replaced or limiting whatever needed to be limited, even before they packaged them up and got them into the helicopter and on the go. That was occupied a substantial part of my interest for the 10 years that we were there. Just sorting through. I mean, you talk about it, and in 15 minutes, you give the story of 10 years worth of, or 20, you know, of people working on it. The other thing, of course, I don't think I've really gotten into the business with Tom Myers, who came up. We have talked about him coming and agreeing to come to work with me for a period of time just to see how things, you know, whether or not we were compatible and if he really, this was really what he wanted to do. And both things were, you know, we were compatible and it was what he wanted to do. And the one thing that he was not able to do, as you well know, Tom Myers is, first off, he's a historian, and he's also a card-carrying Grand Canyonophile, you know, of the worst sort. and with our schedule, when there was just two of us on staff year-round, and we were still basically providing 24-hour care, it meant that we would be on for 36 hours and then off for 12. 36 and 12, 36 and 12. Now, we did a lot of shifting around, you know, and we would also sometimes hire a guy who, these people who particularly ER, emergency room types, who will come and work sometimes for a week and give us opportunity to take some time off. But Tom never got enough time to really do what he wanted to in the canyon. He wanted to walk from one end of the canyon to the other, and I think he still does this on New Year's. I believe they still hike to Phantom Ranch.
He just did.
Just did. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And took the family?
Oh yeah. Oh okay. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So you know, I so admire the fact that they do that, and it's a really important part of his life, and he could see the handwriting on the wall. If he stayed in Grand Canyon, he was going to lose his capacity to be able to do some of the hardcore hard work of hiking and climbing and all the rest of it, and not be able to do some of the things he wanted to. So when he to make a shorten the story here, by the years that I had been the person in charge of the facility at both Yosemite and at Grand Canyon, colleagues that I would run into, or people we'd get the word out, you know, that we used to advertise, so, you know, although in the medical journals, there used to be a section in the back of the journal that listed, you know, doctor wanted, physician wanted, you know, apply to whatever, and we would, whenever we really, you know, were looking for somebody and hadn't been able to tap into any of our network, then occasionally we would do that. But then we'd also go to meetings, you know, go to the seminars and things. which mostly people do online now. It used to be that every medical organization worth its title would put on a postgraduate course of some kind. And family practice was the same thing. I think they did a week. And of course, it would be in Phoenix, and it would, or Tucson, and it would be someplace that had a golf course, and someplace that had really nice accommodations, et cetera, et cetera. So everybody benefited to a certain degree. The docs, we would have docs coming down here from New Hampshire and Maine and Minnesota.
This would be in the winter when the weather was nice. Yeah,
and they just loved it. You know, the ability to come down and go swimming and play golf, et cetera. Plus, the organization put on a pretty good session. You know, training.
Continuing education.
Continuing education, exactly. Okay. Thank you. And but these days, I don't know where all that stands now.
Still going on, I believe. I mean, yeah, you can do it online, but that one-on-one collegiality is still important as well.
So we would, everybody would talk to each other. Oh, where are you from? Oh, well, Grand Canyon. So that would launch a conversation, you know. And with Yosemite, it was the same thing. And only more so because California has got 30 million people in it, you know, and the doctors to go with them. So any organizational thing that I would go to, there was this immediate recognition. They may never have heard of Jim Wergler, but by God, they sure had heard of Yosemite. So it was always a conversation starter. And to a certain degree, the same thing here. And people would ask, geez, how do you get a job there? I can't tell you the number of people who expressed an interest, sort of, you know, superficially. But as soon as they, you know, understood really had a grasp of the rural environment,
Wait a minute, you mean I'm going to work 36-12?
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
So we did not have people clamoring to join the forces at either place. So we would be, you know, always kind of on the lookout. So when Tom approached me in approximately, I don't know, 98, 99, whatever it was, and it told me that he and Becky had decided that they were going to move to Flagstaff, I just had kind of did not have the whatever it took, the enthusiasm, the willingness to put out the kind of effort, you know, to search for another person, because not everybody worked out. Not all the people that I hired for a variety of reasons over the years were the kind of people who decided they did want to, as a matter of fact, to spend the rest big part of their life, and so I, Williams, I may have expressed this before, that the Grand Canyon Clinic was a clinic that was operated, not truly owned by, because the Park Service owned it, you know, the building and all the rest of it, but most of the furniture and equipment and just the expense of operating, paying the help, and all the rest of it, that was Samaritan, and then Banner Health. Williams also was under the umbrella of Samaritan. And Tom and I both had been down here on a number of occasions. They needed somebody to cover a weekend or a holiday. I think my first Christmas that we were in Grand Canyon, I spent here in Williams because, you know, the docs who lived in Williams, they wanted to be gone or with their families or whatever. So I helped them out. So anyway, the point is, they were always looking for a doc also. They had the same problems. And so Tom and I approached the clinic manager, who'd been the clinic manager for a number of years and was kind of like Lucy in that she was the glue that held this facility, Cindy Christman, and asked her if Tom and I could share a position. And we decided, okay, well, we'll have Tom work a month and then have me work a month. And that actually worked well, with the exception, the problem is that I was always behind in my paperwork. I don't care where I was, Yosemite, my residency, Grand Canyon, you know, stacks of charts on the desk, and I would put it off and put it off, and then I'd come in and try and clean it all up, you know, and then I'd make phone calls, and then the phone calls would initiate the process. Well, I need to call this person down in Phoenix about that, and I need to. So it just never really, I could never say, okay, this is my month off, and I can go do anything I want to with it. Now, Michael Collier made it work for him big time, because he was such a focused guy and would plan his life. You know, he knew when he was going to go to Alaska and fly around and take pictures, and he would feed it into his what his work schedule was, because he was allowed pretty much to do the same thing, to work a period of time and then be off a period of time. But when that's kind of what finally really, okay, I'll be even more specific, and it's all her fault. Because I had what's the word when you're hesitant?
Reluctant?
Not just reluctant, but not able to make up my mind. Huh. Not able to commit, you know, to say, okay, yeah, fine. I'm no longer responsible for all these people living here at Grand Canyon. They depend on me as their doctor to be available to do this and do that and all the rest of it. And one day she says to me, what are all these people going to do when they carry you out of here in a pine box?
They'll find someone else to take care of them.
And that was like the sort of the Zen moment where I said, yeah, you know, they will have to figure out something else. I can't be, you know, that kind of a support system as a physician for the rest of my life or for the rest of their life. So that's when Tom and I got serious about the job with down here at Williams, and we moved down here and rented a house over on Sherman.
Yeah.
And
it was January of 1999. That we moved in.
Yeah. So, and down here, even then, the clinic was not really open 24 hours a day. It was, had the facility in, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night or something like that. Really kind of, I've forgotten the details. But the fact is that.
As I remember, the doors closed at 8 o'clock.
Was it 8? Okay, it was.
Yeah. And then they had an emergency phone or something number?
Not there at the clinic, I don't think.
Well, whatever. Okay.
That was good. Anyway.
We had that at Grand Canyon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That would go to dispatch, and then dispatch would send over.
And, of course, we didn't have that arrangement down here. The thing that really sticks to my mind, and I may have mentioned this before, too, is that when we moved down here, it was the first time since I had been a sophomore in medical school, which would have been 1956, 7, that I had not slept with a phone next to the bed. Right. I even had one in Vietnam. I don't think it worked half the time, but you know, there was a phone there that they could call me out, and so that. I got that story straight, don't I?
Yeah, I used to say I didn't include your college or medical school years, whatever, but I would say this is the first time in 40 years that the phone is across the room, you know, it's on a table across the room.
Well, let's kind of open that up a little bit, because I do remember something that Dr. Myers had said, that the locals at Grand Canyon started using the after-hours emergency services because they knew there was a doctor, a nurse, and a lab tech, somebody to push the x-ray. They knew that was there in the middle of the night. And they also knew that if they made an appointment during the day, not only would they have to wait, but they would lose work hours at work. So they could show up at 3 or 4 in the morning, pick up the emergency phone, that would dispatch off to Park Service dispatch, who would call the nurse would come over, mm-hmm. they'd say, well, I have a problem, so-and-so. Nurse would go, oh, I better call the doctor, you'd come in, or you need an x-ray. And so it was a way that some of the locals used as a way to immediately get in the back door and get in to see the doctor. Now, this is what I have heard as a rumor.
Yeah. You know, that never, if that was happening, I think mostly it happened after we left.
Okay.
But I can see the potential for it happening. But if it was happening, I was largely oblivious.
Okay.
To it, because see, my take on it is that if a person came in after hours, and we would tend to go ahead and be fairly flexible if it was early evening or a reasonable time, because we really didn't get called much after midnight. If we got called after midnight, it was always trouble. It was going to be drugs and or alcohol involved, or trauma of some kind, or somebody with a behavioral health problem, although they tended to hit the door a little before midnight, but it always took at least 2 hours to resolve it, to get them on the road, down to Flagstaff, all of the logistics of making arrangements to get them down. But the business of people coming in at 3 o'clock or whatever, see, the thing is, we had a really stable staff. By that I mean, these are people who were, oh, it's Waters. The staff were members of the community. They knew. I mean, you know, we had the people who were on the staff were recognized people in the community, and the community basically didn't get by with mistreating them. First off, they knew if they showed up at the door, and particularly with kind of a story that didn't really add up to being that much of an emergency, they got sent home.
Okay.
But with the things now, with North Country, their staffs are don't have that kind of engagement, I think, in the community to a large degree. Since Tom has continued to be there. Now, this is before they went into the deal where they now close the doors at 8 o'clock and there's nobody available, right? If somebody calls, it's like it goes to dispatch and the rangers answer the call and the ambulance service just hauls them into Flagstaff. At great expense, I might add. But anyway, Tom now, of course, has a much more current view of how things are working. I don't know if that responded to your question about that.
No, it was just that was something that I had heard. You know, sort of thinking about the straws that were too many for the camel, if you will.
Yeah.
That eventually had you guys go, you know what, let's go to Williams. Let's just do a job share month on, month off. We'll split one position, the two of us, and just kind of land back into more of a normal medical practice, if you will, mm-hmm. where you're not on two people, a 24/7, 365 job.
Yeah. Yep. And you know, it's the ability for people to get from Williams to Flagstaff is pretty reasonable. Until this winter, but people were accustomed down here to being aware that if they had a certain problem, if it was really a true bona fide emergency, the 911 was the answer. But if it was something that somebody felt that this laceration that needed to be sutured. And as far as I know these days, they hardly suture lacerations. They staple them, right? I mean, that's what I hear anyway. Things have just been, there's so many changes in the world that now I'm behind the eight ball on those things.
Right, well, things are definitely changing. I did have a question for you. I wanted to go back into the to 1990s.
Okay.
It seemed as though there was a period. Talk about hyponatremia, the ability to drink so much that your mineral content in your blood drops, and as you mentioned, you go into seizure and your kidney failure. It's a fairly serious medical emergency. As much as uncontrollable core temperature, where you start overheating, and all of the physiological things that happen when you basically cook yourself in too much heat, with heat stroke, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
So it seemed as though in the early 90s there was a push that people just needed to drink more. They just weren't drinking enough.
Mm-hmm.
When was it that it was really implanted on your radar screen that the park and Nancy Meekum and the Park Service needed to get a better handle on it wasn't just drinking, but you had to drink and eat.
Yeah,
because the park did then make that change,
mm-hmm.
To say, you know, there was a time when I really wanted to push water, and you saw that on the wayside signs at the trailheads.
Yeah,
you saw that change happen in those signs.
Yeah, and you know, the really big push, from my perspective, occurred after we left.
Okay.
In the early 2000s, when they. They finally put all the pieces together and realized that just telling people to drink more got them into trouble. Trying to make a judgment, telling them, well, you should drink this much, and it was the combination of being able to replace, and it was the salty stuff too. I mean, potato chips, says have a bunch.
As Dr. Meyer says, goldfish. Those little salty,
yeah.
crusty,
yeah.
Cookie things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So, and they also then I think kind of makes. I don't know who's responsible for making this happen. It probably typical bureaucracy. It started at the lower echelon of people on the trail, the rangers who actually were doing the search and rescue, if you will, they would then discuss it with the folks at a higher level, and there would be this up, you know, information going up and certain amount of information going down, but it had to finally be, I expect the folks down at FMC, who basically were the ones who were training the park medics, and the EMTs and the different levels that exist in the park, they also, I think, deserve a substantial amount of credit for being willing to go to the Park Service, talk to the folks at the Park Service, and initiate the kind of conversation that needs to go to convince people that, yeah, you guys know enough about this, that and then also, if you say, look, if you can keep people able to function on the trail by changing what they eat and drink, and you save one helicopter flight, then you know that it's it becomes an issue of what's in the financial best interests.
Well, that and safety as well. I mean, we sort of take it for granted that the helicopter is safe, but those people's lives are at risk in those machines.
Yeah.
As we have seen tragically in Flagstaff in years gone by.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. The ability to triage people on the ground, fluff them up is the park term. Yeah. To get them up the trail on their own power and get them to their car and going home is way better than anything else.
Now, what do they call it?
Fluffing them up.
Fluffing.
Yeah, yeah. So they get down to Phantom and they realize, I cannot do this. I need a helicopter. And so their job, the ranger's job, is to fluff them up.
Yeah.
It takes a couple of days. They're going to calm down those real weak blisters or get their electrolytes under control, whatever needs. Mm-hmm. And they get back into shape and then get them up the trail on their own power without having to jeopardize the flight, the personnel, and not only expense of the machine. Yeah, yeah. So, rumor has it you've been on the city council of the little town of Williams.
Yes.
What got you into running for that position? How did you manage that?
Well, it came sort of indirectly through the Chamber of Commerce. When we got here, the person who was the CEO and president, executive director, whatever title they wanted to do for the Chamber of Commerce was a lady by the name of Donna Cochran.
Yeah.
And we knew her because her husband was the person who was the painting contractor for a house that we built in Mariposa.
Hmm.
So Jody and Dan Cochran, he was really good to work with. I mean, it was like he was never, he was as enthusiastic about identifying exactly the right color as she was. and Donna is an artist painter. So we knew about her. There's a picture in here somewhere by her, isn't it?
Well, they're somewhere else, yeah. They're not. That's one.
The one there. Right there. That's one of Donna's.
Yeah.
She had been a person who had been in the kind of the Yosemite area. She had learned.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
She had done some of her painting, her learning how to paint. With some people that we knew through Yosemite because they were engaged in, like up here, you know, there are these civilians who do stuff. The people, some of the people who work in the library, but just the place where they keep all of this stuff.
The archives, the museum collection.
Yeah, the archives, sure. Yeah. And also, so there were a couple of artists in the Oakhurst area that she associated with, we had a contact with her. When we moved down here, she asked me, after we'd been here for maybe a little while, if I would be willing to serve on the board of directors of the chamber. It, not all that many physicians, you know. First off, I was really oriented, both through Yosemite and Grand Canyon, for the importance to, in order to maintain a viable, survivable organization, business, if you will, I had to pay attention to the people who were going to be my customers, my patients. And we talked about that earlier in this, how the situation changed from summer to winter. The 60% of locals in the winter were our customers, and in the summer it was 60% visitors. But if you ignored the locals in either one of those capacities, it could not generate enough revenue to. So I was really into the tourism aspect of things, and of course, what's Williams got to offer? Well, tourism. So Donna asked me if I would be willing to, and we were friends, and you know, we've had these all connections and networking and all. So I agreed to do that. Well, the next thing you know, I've become the secretary, and then the treasurer, and then the vice chair, and then the chair, and then the immediate past president or past chair. So I just, you know, went through this and got to know the business people in the community and the people who, anybody who has any dealings with matters that were pertinent to the function of the community of Williams. And I guess I probably... I think it's fair to say that I'm a problem solver in terms of trying to find a way to make things work. I'm not a good paper problem solver. I'm not into that. But the fact is that I work well with people. I have mutual respect, you know, for people who have different capacities and all. So anyway, went through this chamber thing. And then one of the council members about maybe 10 years ago, that'd be about right. Mm-hmm. I retired in 05. Anyway, so about 07, roughly. One of the requirements to be on the city council is you have to be a resident within the boundaries of Williams, within the city limits. And one of the members had been elected when he was in the city. Then he had decided to move out of town, outside the boundary, and he was going to go ahead and just serve his term and not run again. And there was kind of a bit of a rabble-rouser kind of a guy on the council who was not... One of the reasons he got himself elected was because he felt that there were some things that needed to be corrected in terms of the functioning of the city administration, the city staff, and the council's sort of basic kind of philosophy of how to make a small community work. And he pushed the issue, in essence forcing the other guy to resign his position on the council. And so that happened. And so then the mayor, who's John Moore, I don't even know for sure. I know he was on the council prior to becoming mayor. He and I had a conversation, and what it boiled down to was, in a way, you know, he asked me if I had the ability to change my mind. We didn't discuss change my mind in what way, just whether or not I was open to looking at alternatives. That's kind of what it boiled down to. And I said, oh, yeah, nope, I can do that. So he was the one who then was sort of engaged in identifying a couple of three people who were eligible to be appointed. And appointed to the council, not voted in.
To fill an empty empty seat.
That's it.
For a certain amount of time until new elections could be had.
Right, and it was about a year, maybe a year and a half, roughly, something like that. And of course, by then, I'd been in town for enough years, and I'd practiced medicine here.
10 years or so.
And so I was, we actually practiced medicine here exclusively only at like 7 years, 99 to 05.
Oh, okay. Okay,
but I'd gotten to know, and then by being on the chamber.
But this was 2010, so you'd been in town. You'd been a known commodity for a decade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that I was appointed to fill out, and then I decided to run for election. And that would have been 8 years ago, because I went through 1 4-year term, mm-hmm. and then I decided to run for a second 4-year term. Mm-hmm. And then I finally decided this year, kind of the last minute, okay, fine, I think I can last another 4 years, mm-hmm. and ran for re-election in 16. Mm-hmm. And so got reelected. So
you've been on the council at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it would have been 06 or 07 when you were appointed.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. It would. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, that's the logic for. And it's been an interesting journey, because I've gotten to be appointed to a variety of boards, and let's see, what else have I, well, NARBA, of course, has been.
How'd you get involved there?
The people at the Guidance Center.
Ah.
One day, over at the clinic,
mm-hmm.
the guy who was the executive director of the Guidance Center in Flagstaff asked me if I would be interested in serving on the board of the Guidance Center.
So this is the Northern Arizona Behavioral Association?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Behavioral health. Thank you.
And it's focused on the population that is served by this particular, the Guidance Center, NARBA, and so forth, are pretty much the Medicaid population. These are people who don't have private insurance, don't have enough money to pay for behavioral health care. And the state was sued 20 plus years ago for not providing adequate behavioral health care.
Hmm.
And that thing was just dismissed like last year. And so there's been, money has been poured into Arizona shockingly for, you know, but it's money well spent, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, so the other thing is that we had provided space at the clinic at Grand Canyon for one of the providers from the Guidance Center to come to Grand Canyon and serve the population up there. Now, I don't have any idea if they're, I don't think they're still doing that, and I don't think they've done it for a long time.
They were when I left it, and then they did telemedicine for behavioral health.
Oh,
right.
Which was pretty neat as well, just because it allowed that service to continue.
Right.
But that was up to a couple of 3 years ago. So.
Yeah. So anyway, I already had established a relationship kind of with the behavioral health environment. So when they asked me to be on the Guidance Center, I said, sure, I'll do that. As a member of the Guidance Center board, each board of multiple providers in the five northern Arizona counties had a person from their board assigned to serve on the board of NARBA. And it's a long story. It is not anything that is of any pertinence to anything, except for the fact that that's how I got in there. And I was on both boards for a period of time. I was on the Guidance Center board, and I was on the NARBA board. And then somebody at the state level decided that there was a conflict of interest, that I couldn't serve on both boards. So I had to make a choice. So I chose to be on the NARBA board because I felt that I had a more opportunities there to be engaged in kind of a broader universe, if you will, geologically or geographically. Yeah, geographically. Freudian slip there, probably. Anyway,
well, didn't they need a doctor, an actual MD on that board, and they hadn't had one?
Not that I know of.
Oh, forget it.
Yeah. So anyway, I decided, okay, well, I'll resign from the Guidance Center board, and I'll just stay with the NARBA board and see where that goes. Well, here we are. NARBA 1.0 doesn't even exist anymore. They joined forces with Health Choice of Arizona to create an organization, an agency that provides both physical health and behavioral health.
Hmm.
And it's called Coordinated Care. And I'm now on the, and once that was put together and a bid was made to the state for the funding of this new organization in lieu of the NARBA itself, it ceased to exist as the NARBA 1.0, and the retained earnings that were obtained from the way the contract was written with the state and the feds allowed a new organization called the NARBA Institute.
Hmm.
And I am now on that board and chairman of that board.
Hmm.
And there's only four of us on the board. I'll be doing that for a while.
So life is busy.
I guess as long as I can serve on the council, I figure, okay, I can probably still serve on the NARBA Institute board.
Hmm.
But either way, it works. If I become physically or mentally incapacitated to the point that I can't serve on both, I won't serve on either.
Right. Sorry. Right.
So that's anything else that you can think of?
No, I think we're slowly drawing to a close in what has been an incredibly wonderful 7 visits here to capture an amazing journey, an amazing life. Any last reflections on looking at medicine, on looking at rural medicine, on looking at the state of the union today, and where, you know, what are you hopeful for in the future?
First, I want to pay my respects to the North Country. What's the official title for North Country? It's North Country not behavioral health. It's North Country
healthcare. Is it the community health service?
Yeah,
North Country Healthcare. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. They have now 15 locations in Arizona where they are responsible for survival of a healthcare providing capacity in 15 basically rural areas in Arizona, which to me, I had just doing it for one, you know, was all I could deal with. And so I know that there are, everything's not perfect. Nothing's ever perfect. The fact that they have been able to continue to find the funding and the staffing, it's got to be a struggle, because it was a struggle for me at just trying to keep one clinic functional, viable, you know, over a period of years. So I give them full bore credit for being able to do that. I don't know what the future holds for. Depends. You can take a really pessimistic perspective, or you can say, well, things will work out eventually. And that we keep coming to a crossroad of some kind. I don't know the exact numbers, but healthcare in in the United States makes up 20% of the GDP. The gross domestic product of trillions of dollars, 20% of it is spent in healthcare, way more than any other industrialized country. And here we are starting a new presidency, a new administration, people vowing to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. And I think that I know that there are people with cooler heads who are engaged in trying to figure out how to prevent chaos, how to prevent disaster, how to continue to provide for the care of people who many millions did not have access. And as once another thing, and I'm sure you probably are well aware of, a huge medical bills are the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country. That still exists, and it probably will for a while, but it's not nearly as bad as it was prior to the ACA. I forget, it was on TV, I think. One of the talking heads talking about, or maybe it's on radio, talking about the issue of a lot of people, including me, have asked the question, how could there be enough people in this country who would vote to elect the person that was just elected? He's got so much baggage that he brings to the table, even to the point of it being, some of us believe, a fatal error of some kind. But the question is, okay, so he's been elected. That means there were enough people in this country who, in essence, ignored what the rest of us were saying, that there's, you know, this is an evil person who wants to do evil things, who's likely to bring down even our possibly our democracy and other things, the worst case scenario. But this is the same person who asked the question. Ask that question, says at the same time, you also have to acknowledge that there were enough people in this country to elect Barack Obama for 8 years. So, you know, it's like, okay, I take great comfort in acknowledging that I'm troubled that his legacy is being so
destroyed.
Well, destroyed is part of it, but disrespected.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
And all of the stuff, the ugly stuff, you know, that's been happening in terms of race issues, gender issues. The things that always, just the survival of our democracy, but, you know, it's almost like every day as I turn on the TV and watch way too much of it, I keep having this sense of hope that there are enough people who are willing to stand up for what's right and what's what I consider to be finding solutions to problems. There's always going to be problems. You can't just wave a magic wand and make them go away. You can't just ignore them. And so, actually, there seems to be, in all the turmoil that we always seem to be going through, do you realize that we are today engaged in three wars? And when you look at our national debt, and all this stuff that we haven't been paying for all these years, We like to say, well, we're not at war with anybody. Well, not the typical, not the old war, but we've been in Afghanistan for 16 years. It's like, we have to face up to the reality. What do you got?
Nothing.
Oh, okay. Nothing. I thought you were about to tell me something. Anyway, that's...
No, it's interesting because it's... And to get out of a recession, a deep depression, if you will, that we've been in, you know, 2008, we had to put a lot of funding into that.
Mm-hmm.
By simply increasing the deficit.
Yep.
And so the stars are aligning now in some very uncomfortable ways. You know, I'm sort of wondering, you know, the sorts of things you talk about in council, trying to look down the road, trying to figure out how to run a city, how to keep the potholes patched, how to keep the public safety funded, police, fire, these sorts of things.
Drill for water.
Water is, of course, in this community of Williams, Arizona, I believe your wells are 3,000 to 5,000 to 7,000 feet deep. Some phenomenal distance.
Nothing over 5.
Well, that's only a mile. No biggie there.
To say nothing of the cost of bringing the water up. I mean, that's like $10,000 a month for electricity.
Heavy lift pumping.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, anyway, kind of in response to what I hear you asking, that's one of the reasons, what I'm about to tell you is the major reason that I'm still on the city council. Everybody in town knows that I'm a flaming liberal, and I'm probably on the opposite side of the coin of at least 60% of the population in terms of philosophical things, politically. That is an area that simply is left at the door when I walk into the city hall. And my associates, you know, there are six of us on the council plus the mayor. We never are engaged in the kind of stuff that you get on big city councils. There's always people who are pushing their agenda. Our only agenda, all seven of us, is just to figure out how to keep the lights on. And how to accommodate the needs of people in providing clean water, safe sewage system, and eventually, hopefully, do something about the roads, although they're on the bottom of the list of the stuff we spend money on right now. But it's a pleasure and joy working with the colleagues that I have. We have different interests. The guy on my left has got works for the Forest Service. He's got kids in school, I think one in high school. So he's devoted to looking at ways to make, you know, to make the system school work and all. I'm sitting there feeling good about the fact that I can be engaged in trying to do our best to make the school, improve the school, keep the clinic functioning, provide a environment for the business people who provide $5 million worth of sales taxes to keep the city operating. You know, the guy on my right is a third or fourth generation Williams guy. So conservative that he's a rancher, and ranchers tend to, you know, have their own philosophy. He and I are on the same page. We're not sitting there casting barbs at each other, you know. John Moore is the mayor. He's the best politician of the bunch. He can go down to Phoenix and talk to people, and everybody knows him because he dresses in his cowboy gear and he's got this black hat that he wears. He just recognized widely.
Well, and he's the person that's on the billboard on I-40 that says you're wanted in Williams. That's the mayor. Yes.
Yeah. and the guy next to him is a retired. The guy lives across the street. Don Dent. He's a native of Williams. He and I probably are about as far apart. He does not really respect, in my judgment, the role of the retail people. It's almost like, now these are just business people. It's kind of like, okay, but these business people, you know, are keeping us going. Yeah, the guy next to him is a conductor on the train. And
The Grand Canyon Railway.
Grand Canyon Railway, yes. Yeah, right.
Well, there's BNSF.
Yes, not BNSF, right. The train.
Well, and what's interesting about Don Dent, it must be the he was an insurance agent, broker. Yeah, you know, and so, but that's not retail, I guess, is it?
I've never been able to figure out how he justifies not having the kind of enthusiasm for being able to provide a really favorable retail environment for the people who are selling it. It's almost like he's...
You know what? I think the idea retail means the gift shops, which has ticky-tacky, schlock stuffs, not all of them.
Rubber tomahawks is the classic description.
Well, yeah, although I've never seen a rubber tomahawk.
Me either. But
they have rubber band guns, you know, the wooden guns that you put, the kids use and all. But however, I think that's his problem. He probably thinks there's too many of them.
He may get fed a lot of this, I think, maybe from his wife, too, because she may have kind of some issues having to do with whether or not we have quality merchandise.
Oh, no.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. You can take that back. Strike that.
Okay, strike that. Yeah, don't record that. Anyway, who's the last one in the row there?
You already did. No. Oh, that's right. We have a new one.
Yeah,
yes.
The guy, one of the incumbents was not reelected this year. And a new person who's
it's a
woman. Hey. First woman that we've had on the council for all the duration that I've been there.
Right. There was a woman before, at some time, you ever got there. Right. Yeah.
So she is the person who's in charge of the Civitan. Are you familiar with Civitan? Civitan is an organization that takes care of people with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of disabilities.
Yeah. Mental as well as physical.
And they've got a camp north of town here. And people come from the cities and so forth. They do a fantastic job, really good, and she, Dawn, is got her Civitan organization has an office and a training center down there to train people how to work in retail establishments and stuff like that if they have that capability. So she's the newest member of our council. Mm-hmm. Once again, I was on the chamber board of directors with her, so I have already established a personal relationship with her. We understand each other. We're all pretty much on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the things that I feel a sense of doing good.
Your social activism.
Yes,
is that it?
Yes, yes,
is that what
yes.
It's
called? My socially active self.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that does it.
That does it. Thank you so very, very much. Jody, thank you.
You're welcome.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to this that you thought?
No, not really. But thank you for for doing this with our
thank you for life letting
story.
Me. Thank you for letting me. It's yep. been a lot of fun. So then this concludes part 7, oral history with Jim and Jody Wergler for the Grand Canyon Historical Society. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Maybe our grandchildren will thank you. I don't think our children are going to want to have anything to do with this, but the grandchildren and maybe the great-grandchildren.
We live in hope.